Dear Friday, you arrive every week amid feelings of longing and expectation, and much to our listeners' disappointment, you never fail us. You, unlike our hungover and broken writers, always arrive on time and never miss a beat. And so once again, we take advantage of your good name and reputation to selfishly pander our meaningless and droll bickerings over the week's defense news. In short, you, yes, you, the unlucky listener, are screwed, because you've tuned into the Def Rep Weekly Recap. It's like waiting for that mystical North Korean missile launch. You just kind of want to be there, just in case it epic fails. And we're running short of writers willing to contribute today, so that pretty much leaves Jonathan Dowdall, our Brussels-based correspondent. John, say hello.
Hi, Rob.
And me, your Defense Report editor, Robert Densmore. John, I heard you gave Keith a bloody nose and busted lip. Is this true?
I cannot confirm or deny that.
Well done. Awkward. And now on to our rapid-fire headlines. Number one, welcome to Azawad, Africa's newest country, and this from The Atlantic. The Tuareg rebels on April 6 declared their independence from Mali and announced the formation of the state of Azawad. That action was condemned or ignored by the international community. In a thoughtful article, William Mosley, a professor of geography and African studies at Macalester College, puts Azawad in the context of the larger issue of Africa's colonial borders. But he fails to explain how they produced such a fine, sleek, urban, off-roading vehicle designed for German carmaker Volkswagen. Not so smart now, are we, Mr. Mosley? Number two, Foreign Secretary, we're on track to complete transition. This from the UK MOD press office. Mr. Haig's comments were made in his monthly Afghanistan Progress Report for March, in which he highlighted the Afghan National Security Force's increasing growth and capability. He says, we remain on track to complete the transition process by the end of 2014. The Foreign Secretary's comments were made in an obscure form of King's English political doublespeak. When translated, his statement actually reads, we need to get out now. 2014 is as good a deadline as any, as that's when the Americans are leaving, and Lord knows we don't want to be left holding the bag on this one. And number three, Royal Gibraltar Regiment soldiers guard the crown jewels. This also from the fine folks at the UK MOD press office. Soldiers from the regiment have been guarding Buckingham Palace and St. James Palace, and a third group of troops have been performing the equally important task of guarding the crown jewels. Sergeant Major Dean Castry explained, as well as providing two sentries throughout the day, our primary role is to provide a quick reaction force, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Every day we carry out clearance patrols where we look for anything out of the ordinary. And we thank you, Mr. Castry, Major Castry, I should say, for all of your fine work. Carry on. Now that's it for the serious stuff. On to the lighthearted news. John, Africa has been on the radar for you this week. What do you have?
Sure. So I just wanted to speak a little bit today about the news that came out of The Hague this week regarding Charles Taylor, former president of Liberia and now convicted war criminal, the first such ruling against the head of state since the Nuremberg trials of former Nazis in World War II. This ruling is a huge milestone in the movement towards a legalistic approach to war crimes that emerged out of the 1990s, where a series of protracted civil wars, in this instance the Sierra Leonean Civil War, which was particularly brutal in many of its details, which Charles Taylor is essentially accused and has been found guilty of fueling by his material and weapons support for the RUF, the rebel group from which we have terms such as blood diamond, and also 120,000 people dead or displaced, an absolutely horrendous conflict.
So pretty serious stuff, yeah.
Pretty serious stuff. So what does this case mean? I mean, first of all, it highlights a lot of the controversies about the legalistic approach to humanitarian intervention, which are still unanswered. Already, of course, this ruling will be protested by his lawyers. It's likely that that will be upheld and that he will be sent to prison here in the UK, which is just another illustration of some of the complexities here. The UK is going to be hosting a former head of state as a convicted war criminal within its prison system.
Excellent.
And I think more to the point, looking at some of the conflicts which are still unfolding around the world today, rulings like this matter because we are currently engaging in military operations, obviously Libya in 2011, on humanitarian grounds, the responsibility to protect, the R2P doctrine, where UN will mandate the use of force to end a civil conflict. And of course, Syria, as we've been discussing on the recap recently, is an ongoing and extremely volatile situation, which could, many people will say, result in some form of intervention if peace cannot be found within the warring parties. So when you see a former head of state formally indicted, the first of its kind in 50 years, you've got to be thinking that any head of state out there who is conducting these kind of activities knows that even if it has to take 11 years after the crimes are committed, even if it has to be in Holland, you could be found guilty and put in prison for your crimes. And it may not sound like defense news, but as far as I'm concerned, this is the point. When we go into these situations, you know, 800 troops were sent to Sierra Leone, British soldiers, to try and finish that civil war. This is about conflict, and this is about bringing justice to people who are inflicted by absolutely horrendous civil strife. And I think that when we look at Syria, when we look at Libya, ongoing trials there, which are going to start soon, regarding the rule of Gaddafi and war crimes, which he's almost certainly going to be held responsible for by history and his family and his other ministers, this is important.
We have a big burden to carry in Africa, John. I would agree. And I think that the UN and NATO, for good or for worse, I think that they have failed in many respects in previous conflicts. And I think of the former Yugoslavia, I think of Bosnia, I think of Kosovo, where incidents that did happen, and I'll talk about one of these in the next story here, were probably equally as horrendous, but didn't get the kind of world court justice that really needed to come about until decades later. And that kind of response is simply not good enough, I agree. And the fact that this is happening, you know, well within this person's lifetime, so that it's going to make a prominent statement that we're taking seriously, and I say we in the international community, that's quite a new thing to say, by the way, this kind of multilateral approach to taking the moral high ground and really following through. I say well done. You know, I'm fully behind this one. I think that it's something that hasn't been pulled off nearly as often as it should have. But maybe this will be a sign of things to come. In keeping with North American themes that I started off last week, John, I've chosen one this week that reflects on the shaping of UK and European defense policy, but very much rests heavily on what the US has been doing over the past 40, 45, 50 years for foreign policy. And it's important because I think the author, David Rothkopf, has hit some solid points. It's called The Enemy Within, and it comes out of foreignpolicy.com. And this is the image he starts with, and I quote, "The United States is a bit like a 375-pound middle-aged man with a heart condition walking down a city street at night eating a Big Mac. He's sweating profusely because he's afraid he might get mugged, but the thing that's going to kill him is the burger. Since the end of the Cold War, America has been on a relentless search for enemies. I don't mean a search in the sense of ferreting them out and defeating them. I mean that America seems to have a visceral need for them." And this is what Rothkopf calls enemy dependency. And it's what keeps American politicians from focusing so much on domestic policy. Now, this has taken somewhat of a backseat recently within the past couple of years because of the recession, the world recession that's hit the U.S., as hard as it's hit other economies, and we're still reeling from that in the UK, obviously, this week's news that we've gone back into recession. And so it's been harder to hide from domestic policy issues. But Rothkopf goes on. He typifies the approach in the war history of the US. You have the bad guy story, the Germans, the Soviets, and in a shaky interim of not so pending threats, there were tin pot bad guys like Manuel Noriega and Slobodan Milosevic. Then came 9/11, and many politicians had their speechwriters simply replace the term Soviets with terrorists. And I would even extend this to aggressor theories like Paul Nitze's domino theory, if we're going to get into the weeds, which drove the Cold War single-handedly, only to be replaced wholesale by a counterinsurgency strategy, which is a huge leap, I know. But it's just as theoretical and reactive as its predecessor's policy. And this a lot of this comes out of the State Department, which is not so active today in generating a lot of these policies, but I think is endemic of the American government institution in creating and verifying threats abroad. And the author goes on to pick on Mitt Romney, which is quite easy to do, whom he says is the progenitor of a kind of reborn all-American bogeyman syndrome. And I quote, "In March, he called Russia America's number one geopolitical foe, following up on his December complaint that Vladimir Putin is a real threat to the stability and peace of the world. But in February, he was warning against the risk posed by China's prosperous tyranny. In March, it was North Korea, one of the world's worst actors. Back in 2009, Romney wrote an op-ed calling Iran the greatest immediate threat to the world since the fall of the Soviet Union, and before that, Nazi Germany. While in 2007, he called jihad this century's nightmare. So, Mr. Romney, I'm afraid you're going to have to make a decision. Actually, which one is the most prominent threat and the century's worst nightmare? But of course, he's not alone, and we all know that. Newt Gingrich has his Chavez, and you know, even Obama in the recent Summit of the Americas was taking a few pot shots at Venezuela and Cuba. The underscoring point being that we are less searching for political ties than for reasons to break ties with potential allies. The enemy is within, he's saying. This is, you know, like the Big Mac metaphor bringing on the heart attack. American politicians distracted or distracting with jumped up bogeymen outside our borders. And in my opinion, it's had some pretty serious repercussions for the UK and could worsen in the case of conflict with Iran or North Korea, which begs a question: when does the UK sever ties with close adherence to US foreign policy? John?
Well, I think it's the first time the Weekly Recap has personally extended a question to a presidential candidate, so I look forward to Mr. Romney's response. I think, obviously, this article hits it on the head in many ways, and the drive towards securitization of a whole range of issues, from border security to immigration, through the prism of the concept of war on terror or the threat of terrorism, has radically changed just so much. And of course, you know, led by the US, the UK, but also a host of democratic nations around the world have really let their standards on a whole host of issues, from civil liberties and so on, just take a real back seat to this overweening fear of terrorism, which is, of course, ironic in more ways than one. So, yeah, I fully agree. And more to the point that if the Big Mac is going to cause the heart attack, obviously this is the financial crisis. This is jobs. We are seeing a huge spike in far-right political perspectives. Look at the recent French election results, where Le Pen, someone who is really far-right on the European spectrum, had votes from 6.5 million French people. I mean, that is a huge number of votes for someone who essentially wants to deport en masse huge portions of his citizens. So yeah, this is going to have ramifications, and yeah, people are saying the war on terror is over. No more boots on the ground, no more counterinsurgency. Let's do some nation building at home, as the Obama administration has been coining these kind of things. But that won't undo the damage of a decade of foreign wars, and then wars at home of various kinds, some of which I might say, in my opinion, have been highly misguided, but that's something to discuss.
Well, we always like to end things on a bombshell, so let's sign off there. Have a great weekend and stay away from those Big Macs, unless, of course, you're Kim Jong-un, in which case, go for it, Kim. From all of us at Defense Report, good day.